Welcome to Management Matters, a National Academy of Public Administration podcast where policy meets practice. I'm Terry Gerton, president of the Academy. As we approach a crucial national election this November, we're all attuned to the importance of effective election management in delivering results that are accurate and trustworthy. Election administration is public administration. And the Academy has just completed an analysis of comparative electoral practices that develops a framework to help election officials prepare for and deliver effective elections. With me today to talk about this new paper are Academy Fellow Larry Cooley and the Academy's Director of Strategic Initiatives and Intergovernmental Programs, Dr. Joe Mitchell. Larry and Joe, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us. We're looking forward to the conversation.
Well, Joe, in fact, let me start with you because the grand challenges fall under your purview at NAPA, and protect electoral integrity and enhance voter participation is one of those. Tell us a little bit more about that particular grand challenge and why it was so important to include it when these were announced in November of 2019.
Great. Well, thank you. So maybe to take a step back, you know, what did we mean by a grand challenge in any space? There were things that had significant implications for the functioning of our government and society. They were long-term issues, so, you know, decade plus, you know, kind of wicked problems that were interconnected, not a lot of easy answers, long-standing, lots of trade-offs, and required, you know, changes in the way we were thinking. And they're also the province of many people. They require cross-sectoral and interdisciplinary work. And, you know, one organization or level of government can't address these in isolation on their own. So that's a little bit about, you know, the nature of a grand challenge in general. And so with the election grand challenge, you know, obviously democracy is about more than just voting, but voting is a critical element of democracy. Citizens need to be able to select their representatives at all levels of government. And so elections are core to the overall focus that we have at the Academy on protecting and strengthening democracy. Some of our other issues that their grand challenges are to modernize and reinvigorate the public service and to develop new approaches to public governance and engagement. So this is all part of how we protect and strengthen democracy as public administrators. And I think this grand challenge underscores the connection between public administration and democracy. As you noted, election administration is public administration, and this aspect of the field is often ignored. There are a few classes on election administration in our public administration programs. For example, the main exception is Auburn University, which offers a graduate certificate in election administration so that we can prepare election administrators, current and future. That's the only national certification program for election officials and vendors in the election administration arena. And so it's just, this is not something that's commonly addressed in curricula. And that's a significant gap in how we educate and train public servants. So that's yet another reason why we think this is a grand challenge. We also, this is a both and issue in terms of electoral integrity and voter participation. So we wanted to emphasize that. And as you remember, when we put this out in 2019, we were remembering the previous presidential election where there was concern about foreign interference and disinformation. Also, more broadly, there's oftentimes concern about voter turnout. Historically, political scientists have been kind of concerned about apathy, but that doesn't seem to be as much of an issue now. It's kind of the flip side of a lot of the social and political divisions that we have, but we're still far from, you know, having 100% voter participation. And there was also concern at the time when we put this out about unnecessary barriers to voting being established. You know, we want to make sure that there's, you know, the fundamental right of eligible voters to vote is protected. So those are just some of the reasons that we thought that this was a really critical grand challenge in our field.
Well, thanks for sharing all of that background, because here we are 5 years past naming it as a grand challenge, and it feels like a lot of those are still relevant. What keeps this on the grand challenge list?
Yep. So I think that we're seeing more and more like a decline in trust in electoral processes and results, you know, despite the fact that, you know, the system is remarkably effective and secure. It delivers results that can be trusted, but there are still lots of questions that people have about it. We all lived through the aftermath of the 2020 presidential election, and, you know, the results were valid. There was no fraud that could have produced a different winner of the presidency, for example. But, you know, there are still lots of challenges at that point to the results. And we are also already hearing concerns that people are coming up with about the 2024 national election, even before they've been held. So it's important to address that, you know, decline in trust. And there was a Washington Post article just this week noting that, especially in swing states, how easy it will be to vote in 2020 depends heavily on geography. That is where you live. So I think this remains very much an ongoing challenge. But all of the grand challenges should be seen as long-term challenges. They're not things that you could solve, quote, solve overnight. Otherwise, it wouldn't really be how grand a challenge would that be if you could solve it with a magic wand.
That's right. That's right. Well, Larry, I want to go to you next because you generously commissioned this study. Tell us a little bit more about your background in public administration, why this was such an important issue for you.
Well, in truth, I feel a little bit like an imposter on this issue. I definitely came into it through the side door. My career is in public management, mostly working on improving public governance and public management in lower and middle income countries. Two things did not directly relate to this study. One, in my world, there's pretty much a distinction, I think a false distinction now that I look back on it, between democracy and governance. And my work was mostly on governance, not on democracy. And secondly, there's been a big distinction between work in the rest of the world and work here in the United States. And my work has been mostly international. So you could say, what the heck was I doing working on this issue? Well, I was working on this issue because I'm an American. And in truth, I was shocked by what happened in 2016, especially in 2020. And coming to step back from it and to look at that against the backdrop of what I've seen in other people's countries and what I've seen in governance, I really concluded exactly what you and Joe both said, which is that this is a public management issue. It's not just a political issue. In fact, it becomes a political issue when it fails to some extent as a public management issue in winning the trust in building the support of the people that it needs. So I've run something for 10 years called the Development Management Network, which was some hundreds of people that cared about management and organizational issues in international development. I've run for the last decade a large community of practice globally on taking innovation to scale. All of these things have assiduously avoided elections, all of them, because we treated that as being something political. And I clearly have changed my mind about that, particularly when people do things which both undervalue and don't reflect what I think is the genuine efforts that's being made by a variety of parties to do strong public management of the electoral process. And so I didn't have conclusions in my head, and I certainly didn't have the data for what all states are doing in this area, but I had a kind of a conviction that there are a lot of people out there trying hard to do the right thing, and that we both help them by trying to highlight some of the things others were doing that they might emulate, and help them and others by trying to point out the fact that much more is right than is wrong with the process.
Well, I love the way that you connected the aspects of governance of the electoral process with governance more broadly and realizing that they can't be disconnected. When you think about this project, do you have advice for other fellows or other folks who might be interested in commissioning specific pieces of thought leadership like this?
I do. I mean, I've been a fellow since 2008. I was on the board for 6 years. I've served on several panels. I've been the tri-chair of the International Affairs Standing Committee. But it never occurred to me to do this until now. And the truth is that this was, as I said, motivated much more as a citizen than it was as a fellow on this. But it occurred to me that two pieces of my life linked rather nicely in this. And something that really struck me when I was on the board, Terry, is that the Academy has got a gap, if we're not careful, between our aspirations to influence public governance and our capacity to do that, because most of our revenue comes from funded studies. So if someone basically hires us to do a piece of work, then we get to work on that. If they don't, we need to find a creative way to put together the resources to make that possible. Well, elections to me was one of those issues. It was an issue where the Academy wanted to be engaged, where the Academy should be engaged, and where nobody was hiring us to be engaged at that point in time. And so it would be like an area to connect something that I was personally interested in was something that I knew the Academy was interested in. And my lesson from it, and if I were passing a message to other fellows, it would be, we can really help the Academy do the work it wants to do on these grand challenges by trying to put forward the resources to do the things that don't just automatically attract the right external fee-for-service client.
Well, I appreciate your thoughtfulness about this and your generosity, because you're exactly right. And this is a case where, as a nonprofit, we have an opportunity to use a variety of funding resources to do this original thought leadership. And I think we're all rightly proud of the work as it's played out. So thank you for supporting it and initiating it at the beginning. Joe, I want to come back to you because you were the project director on this report, and the team identified three pillars of electoral administration. Tell us about those pillars and why they're important.
Great. Thank you. So, yeah, so we developed these pillars, first of all, to maybe take a step back to say, you know, we wanted to articulate a nonpartisan vision for strengthening the election system that, you know, we thought could be broadly shared by Americans of all stripes. We wanted to identify some interesting examples of electoral practices in jurisdictions that we were hoping to highlight for citizens, and recognizing, you know, every state, of course, has different laws, legal and organizational systems that, you know, that jurisdictions might want to consider. We also tried to synthesize key points from a lot of other thoughtful reports that have been out on this topic, you know, by other good government organizations, and then develop options and proposals. So that's kind of how we came up with this. The three pillars, to your point, it's voter experience, election security, and election workforce. So when we think about, you know, what is good public administration in the election context, it's those three things. That's what we want. And so what we're hoping is that people will have that in their mind as they're thinking about, you know, policies and practices, like, does this help the voter experience? Does this help security? Does this help the workforce? So those are kind of the pillars and what we're hoping. And certainly to talk about in a little bit more detail about each of those, obviously voter experience, you know, voters expect and deserve a positive voter experience. I think people are used to ease and flexibility in all parts of their lives now, and they don't see why government can't deliver similar experiences. So that's kind of a broader issue, I think, that we're seeing across all domains of government, then has led to a focus on, you know, customer experience at all levels of government. So we've tried to bring that in. And obviously, Election Day is, you know, a key moment in our democratic process. So people need to have accurate information about when, where, and how to vote. They need to be able to register and cast their vote easily. We need to have accessibility. We need to have as brief a wait times as we possibly can. And then inside states and within individual counties, have consistent practices and opportunities for individuals and groups to provide feedback on their experiences. So that's kind of the voter experience pillar. And we've identified some specific practices there that are in our report that people can take a look at in more detail. Election security, obviously, you need to make sure that you have systems that ensure you can vote and that your vote is counted accurately. Again, as we've talked about earlier, it's important to note that we have an incredibly secure election system in the United States. But obviously, we need to make sure we're able to address evolving, you know, future threats to security. And in that vein, in 2017, the Department of Homeland Security designated elections as critical infrastructure. So in our report, we identify various threats and then potential mitigating practices. It gets a little technical, so maybe our listeners may not want to know all of the detail about that, but it's in our report about various things that can be done to mitigate specific threats. And again, just wanted to reemphasize that we do have a remarkably safe system and secure system. The election workforce is the third pillar. Obviously, we have a decentralized system, but, you know, it's run by individuals. It's run by mostly at the local level. Most election workers serve locally in cities, counties, and towns across the country. And they contribute vitally to the other pillars, the voter experience and election security. So nothing happens without them. And Terry, I know you've been a volunteer poll worker yourself, so you know a lot about this from personal experience. But all the things that this workforce does, including updating their plans to reflect new laws and other new developments, you know, they procure equipment, they continually recruit and train staff, they staff the polling places at early voting sites, absentee ballots on election day and for any recounts, they test test equipment. They maintain secure facilities. They develop the online information portals. They handle voter registration. They provide ballots to people. They do a lot of communications. And so obviously they are critical. And so that's kind of the third pillar there. And we've identified a number of leading practices that are available to, for people to use to make sure that we strengthen this workforce and that we have it available to us in the future.
So, Joe, you mentioned that I have been a volunteer poll worker, and I have to say I highly recommend it for anybody who has questions about how the electoral process works in their communities, because I've seen firsthand in setting up the voting sites and rolling out the equipment and then tallying things up at the end of the day and reporting them that the system really is strong in all of those pillars. But I'm just a volunteer poll worker. Who's the audience for this report, and what do you want them to do with it?
So the audience is actually very broad. So we were looking at, you know, one, citizens. So overall, so that we wanted Americans to have a broader understanding of how the elections are administered. Legislators at all levels of government, especially at the state level, since for the most part, obviously the federal government has a role, but most of the laws that govern elections are state laws, and elected executive branch officials at all levels of government, in addition to, of course, you know, the local election officials. So we think change obviously takes time. We don't expect major changes to be implemented before this November's election. The last thing we want to do is to send out stuff that's like, this is just that many more things that people have to do. But we do think that we're hoping that this can kind of become a paradigm, if you will, for people to say, you know, this is the evaluating practices and policies based on these three criteria. Like, these are the criteria. This is what we're trying to do, and really take a close evaluation of whether we're advancing those three things and how easy we're making it for people to vote, how secure and are we strengthening our workforce.
So I love the organization, the structure, and the practicality of this report. It's like easily readable by anybody, and we hope especially meaningful to election officials. But they have their hands full right now preparing for the national election in November. And as you said, election practices can vary across states and within states. So how should election officials consider these leading practices right now in light of where their own states are with voting practices and preparation?
Right. So I would say that, you know, clearly we have a decentralized election system in the United States. That's one of our strengths that actually promotes security. It promotes being able to be responsive to the people and, you know, work within your community. So that's a real advantage. And so, as I noted earlier, most election policies are decided at the state level. So I would encourage, you know, local election officials, of course, need to make sure that they comply with their state laws. Even people who've been in the field a long time cannot be expected to know everything, however, that's happening outside their jurisdiction elsewhere in the country. So by highlighting leading practices, what we're hoping to do is to raise awareness and to help people consider kind of the art of the possible. If other jurisdictions have done it, maybe you can do it. But obviously, local election officials would only be able to implement practices that are consistent with their state laws. So I think this is where some of this can become something that goes to state legislatures to say, hey, other states are doing this. Why can't we? Why can't we make voting as easy as another state, for example?
Mm-hmm. And we're going to put the report in the show notes so the listeners can access it and share it with whoever they need to in their own networks. But it does have lots of really interesting case studies across the different states about how election officials in a variety of places and in a variety of structures have implemented really promising practices that might be of interest, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And there are practices, you know, for every pillar. So, for example, you know, we have in the voter experience, you know, ways to increase communication and ways to increase opportunities to vote from a registration standpoint, voting ease, accessibility, maximizing options for voting. So we have practices highlighted there. Election security, again, that gets a little technical, but we have stuff around how you address trusted domains and hosted services, how you could manage open records requests as efficiently as possible, chain of custody, all those kinds of things. And certainly with the election workforce, we have a lot of practices that have been implemented that we would highlight for making sure we can recruit, retain, and develop the workforce we need.
And the stories are pretty inspiring, so we want to make sure people check them out. Larry, let me come back to you. As the sponsor of this effort, What do you hope happens next?
Well, in this case, it's for me, learning is the booby prize in this thing. I mean, I hope learning is a mechanism for trying to really make something happen, and in particular to give some support and some substance to the people who are trying hardest to make good things happen. One of the things I've learned from my own work on scaling is that simply holding up good examples usually isn't enough. It fits into some kind of a decision-making process at the local level. So giving the people who are trying to do that some armament, both in terms of being able to cite other states that have done similar things or being able to find colleagues from those places who have done that and could potentially help amplify their own voices, creating something people can convene around, ideally, for example, secretaries of state talking to each other about this or local election officials talking to each other about this. I think using this as a guide for action and as a kind of a stimulus to put substance around it. And this is a case where I think boring is good. I mean, essentially, there's going to be a lot of flash and dash around electoral stuff, and it's going to be mostly framed in political terms. Framing some of this in public management terms so that people who might differ on their preferred outcomes from elections can talk about what they share in their preferred intention for how the election will be run, I think is a huge contribution, but it's only a contribution if somebody really picks this up and runs with it. I think we've done the first step in terms of trying to aggregate some of that information. For me, from the beginning, the most important part of this particular study is the end game, which is how it gets picked up and used by people who can put it to good use, including citizens.
Well, and you laid some interesting things out there, really, in both the near term and the longer term strategy. I mean, we really just have a few months before the big national election in November. So there's going to be a limited amount of things that election officials could do now. But maybe as they take up these recommendations or ideas, a longer term strategy for change.
I think so. I mean, I think we're playing a long game on this. Of course, very real short term dangers on this thing. I don't want to minimize that, but I don't think this is all aimed at November. In fact, on the contrary, I think it's aimed far beyond November. For November, I think the biggest thing we can do is to give people some confidence in the electoral processes that we have. I mean, if you look across these states, the thing that you really see is a lot of people working incredibly hard and for the most part, very, very effectively to make elections fair. And of course, they can do better. And some states are doing better at some things than others that could, in fact, be replicable in other states. So I hope some people will pick that up. But mostly for the near term, I think it's confidence that we're building. Going a little beyond that, I think it's a lot more than confidence. I think both to keep up with new threats and also to keep up with people's concerns on this thing. We've got to show that just like in any other area of public management, this is getting better and better, stronger and stronger, not the opposite. And that people have some way that they're doing that in a meaningful way.
Mm-hmm. I love that confidence. Joe, any last words from you on the details of the paper?
Yeah, well, I guess my last words to the listeners here is I hope you'll read the report. I hope that you find that it enhances your understanding of the election system and can also foster constructive actions over time to advance free and fair elections in the United States. As we all know, people have given their lives to vote. We've worked, generations of Americans have worked long and hard to move us toward a more perfect union. So that's the context within which this is offered. I'd also note that it's April, which is National Volunteer Month. So I'd encourage our listeners to sign up to be poll workers if possible. So the Election Assistance Commission has information on their website about how to sign up to be a poll worker. It's really critical work in terms of setting up and preparing polling locations, welcoming voters, verifying registrations, issuing ballots, all those important tasks of democracy. So would encourage people to do that and just for us to continue to try to work together across all of our divides so that we can ensure free and fair elections for ourselves and future generations of Americans.
Thank you, Joe. And Larry, let me give you the last word.
I think I can't add much more than amen to that. I mean, honestly, when my wife, Marina, and I talked about funding this study, we had something in mind. I would say what's emerged is beyond our expectations. And that I really want to thank the Academy for that. And I want to encourage fellows on this to consider doing something similar in areas that move them. They may or may not be their direct professional domain. This wasn't mine. But I feel really good about what happened, and I hope we can put it to some important end.
Well, Larry, thank you again for your confidence and your support of the Academy and your vision in commissioning this study. Joe, it's a great paper. I want to encourage our listeners to pick up the link in the show notes and take a look. We'd love to hear your thoughts and comments. Thank you both for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
For our listeners, check back every Monday for a new episode from the Academy. As we work to build a just, fair, and inclusive government that strengthens communities and protects democracy.